All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Lovely to see you all. For the few of you joining from Israel, good evening. Thanks for joining. In the past few weeks and past classes, we've noted a few times the power of this metaphor that really traces its way through the Shiva Denachemta, the image of God as a mother, and then that turns into Israel as a mother. And we saw this metaphor, this imagery of motherhood play out in a few different ways. We saw Israel being likened to a woman who has lost her children and the children return. We saw this imagery being used when Israel was referred to as a widow whose husband then comes back. We also saw this metaphor being used with this idea of Israel as a mother who somebody else actually gives birth to the children, so she doesn't herself have to go through labor pains. And we saw this imagery being used, this feminine imagery being used with the trope of a marriage between God and Israel as a divorcee, and God saying, "What do you mean? We never actually divorced. We're still married. Our relationship is still strong." And overall, the piece that I've been saying that I think explains why this is such a powerful imagery for this time of year, for the Shiva Denachemta, is that it's an antidote to the very legalistic and contractual language of Sefer Dvarim, where the relationship between God and Bnei Yisrael is described as a contract where both parties have things that they have to do, and if one of them, reneges, then the contract is broken. And so what the Shiva Denachemta are doing then in relating to the theme of Dvarim is they're providing an antidote for that. In post Tisha B'Av, where we're saying, "Oh my goodness, we saw that we didn't live up to our end of the bargain, and we did get exiled out of the land. What do we do now? Do we still have a relationship with God? What does that look like even? Moshe kind of said, we'll come back, but how do we actually do that?" And so Yeshayahu in the Shiva Denachemta is basically saying it is possible to have a relationship again, but we're going to describe that relationship in ways that remind us that it's unbroken. And that I think really brings us to the Haftarah for this Shabbat, for Ki Teitzeh, where once again the maternal imagery and the feminine imagery are being used. This time, however, it's being used in a way that I think adds a completely new layer that is really fascinating to explore. It's even a bit unconventional. So I'd like to jump straight in to the opening verses of this week's Haftarah from chapter 49 of Yeshayahu. Here we go. Rani akara lo yalada petzchirina v'tzali lo chala ki rabim bnei shomema mibnei be'ula amar Hashem. Shout, I think it's meant to be shout of joy and encouragement. Oh, you infertile woman, you Akara, shout with joy. You who have never given birth to a child, you who have never labored, I think travail in the sense of you've never even suffered the pangs of birth. For the children of the wife forlorn shall outnumber those of those espoused, says God. So it seems like what's going on here is that Israel is a woman who is married to a man, but the man is married to more than one, has more than one wife. So there's the, and one wife is experiencing infertility. In this verse, it seems to be Israel. And the promise here is that, you, the infertile woman, you're going to have more children than the other wife. So it's a really strange image of basically a prophet saying, "Israel, I promise you, you're going to have a sense of comfort. You're going to be restored." But it's expressing it in this image of Israel, part of this marriage where you're experiencing anguish, presumably not just because of infertility, but also because you have had this tension in this marriage situation where the other wife, your husband's other wife, has more children than you, and presumably is that's a source of tension in your life. That's a source of frustration in your life. So the consolation is not merely you're going to have children. The consolation is you're going to have more children than the other wife. So I'll just pause for a moment and just say that throughout Navi, images of infertility and women who are barren is for sure a trope that we've seen multiple times throughout Navi. I'll just give a few examples that I think are worth examining. So first and foremost, from Dvarim, from the sections of the curses from the Tochacha, one of the curses is cursed shall be the fruit of your womb, the fruit of your land, the increase of your herds, the young of your flock. Promises and curses and other verses go on and describe infertility, multiple miscarriages as a sign of the general horribleness of what God is promising. And so I'll just say it makes sense that Yeshayahu, in trying to describe a message of comfort, is basically reversing the curses, right? If prophets in the past, right, Moshe in Dvarim, has basically said that the ultimate punishment is infertility and miscarriage, then the fact that the prophet is now, trying to tell the people messages of comfort, messages of renewal, it makes sense that he's emphasizing one element of your renewal is going to be that you're going to have fertility. We're going to reverse that painful state. I also put two examples on the screen from Hosea, really horrible descriptions and negative prophecies. Ephraim's glory shall fly away like a bird, no birth, no pregnancy, no conception. The second passage, the continuation of that passage from Hosea, really just horrible words to read out loud. Give them, O Lord, what will you give? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breasts. And I'll just say that in my work as Yoatzet Halacha in my own community, infertility and miscarriage, these are things that are still quite silent for the women who are experiencing them, but the reality is they are quite common. And the knowledge that we have through more accurate medical testing just means that women are only more and more aware nowadays if they're experiencing miscarriages and if they're experiencing infertility. And thank goodness there are so many wonderful ways that we can assist couples into becoming families. But these verses, when we read these verses, it's very real, and the pain is very real. So these verses are definitely evoking a pain that is very relatable nowadays. And so the promise of what Yeshayahu is describing is something that is in any generation, I think, truly a message of comfort, truly a beautiful message of renewal. But it is still super strange because the scenario that's being described here, as I said before, is not just, oh, you poor woman, you pained woman who's experiencing infertility. It's not just that. It's you're experiencing infertility, but you've also got this tricky relationship because your husband is married to two women and you're going to have more children than the other woman. Part of the comfort isn't just, oh, lo yalada, you've never given birth, so shout for joy because you'll have children. It's you're going to have rabim bnei shomema mibnei beula. You're going to have more children than that of the other wife. So what's that, right? And why is that the message of comfort? And not just that, why is this the message of comfort chosen for this Shabbat for Ki Teitzei? Because as I said before, I think that each haftarah of the Shiva Denechamta is chosen quite purposefully to connect to that week's parsha, to emphasize the connection to Dvarim, and to emphasize that the haftarah is meant to speak as an antidote to the tone of Sefer Dvarim. And something else that I think is important to consider is that Where a haftarah begins and ends is also really key. Like, think about how this haftarah is framed, where we open with this verse, Rania Kara, right? That's the opening phrase. And so our attention immediately goes to that. And so why do we open with that? So I think we really need to understand this image, and this metaphor in order to make some sense of the haftarah in general. And so I do want to spend some time focusing on this one image. And then expand our attention to the rest of the Haftarah to kind of see how it all works together. So this image, getting back to this image of a husband with two wives and the promise, not just that the woman, one of the wives who's experiencing infertility, is going to give birth, but that she's going to have more children. I think it resonates with the story of the Akarot, the story of the infertile women in Tanakh. And it's actually an image that I think Yeshayahu is assuming we're going to be able to connect the dots in our heads to these other stories. Because think about the fact that of the different stories in Tanakh of women experiencing infertility, there's a trope that a lot of them have, or there's an element that a lot of these stories have, which is not just that, okay, a man and a woman are married and the woman's experiencing infertility and then one day she has a child. So for example, the story of Shimshon's birth, where his mother, Anonymous, Mrs. Anonymous, right? Her, she's not given a name, experiences infertility and then, right, along with her husband, eventually they see an angel and she has a child. But there's a more common version of the story where there's another wife in the picture. So think about the story of Avram and Sarah. Sarah experiences infertility, and the pain of her infertility is coupled with the fact that she experiences profound tension. They bring Hagar into their marriage, and it's not just that, oh, Sarah wishes more than anything that she could have a child. It's that her family, in a sense, her family structure is thrown into chaos when she and Avram decide to bring Hagar into the marriage, with the hopes that maybe Hagar will provide a child that then Sarah and Avraham can, in a sense, raise as their own. And this is actually addressed in other in ancient Near Eastern legal texts, that this was something that was done, basically, a sort of like adoption, so to speak, that had very real consequences legally for who the child belonged to, what the child inherited. Could, if the mother was a slave, did the mother retain the status? In ancient Near Eastern texts and the Code of Hammurabi and in texts from Nuzi, right? These are issues that are addressed there. And then think furthermore of the story of Yaakov and Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah, where Rachel's infertility, it's not just the pain of her own infertility or the wishes, the private wishes that she have a child. It is also compounded by the fact that there's this incredible tension and jealousy with Leah, and the whole relationship, the whole family is in chaos. And not only that, think of the story of Chana and Penina from the book of Shmuel. The very first story framing the entire book of Shmuel, of all the introductions to this stage in Jewish history, it's not a story about how Shmuel heard the word of God. The opening story to the book of Shmuel is not about Shmuel at all. It's about the story of Chana and her infertility and the tensions that she has with Penina. So this kind of image of you've got a man, he has two wives, one wife is experiencing infertility, and the promise of comfort is that you're going to have children, but you'll have more children. In other words, your children will be greater, is something that is like a trope, is a pattern that we've seen in other places in Tanakh. And I think it's quite purposefully chosen, to kind of bring into our minds like all of these other stories, and the placement as the opening of the Haftarah and the placement with the Parsha, I think, is really, really intentional. Because I'll just kind of repeat that point, just try to express it a little bit clearer. If I was just learning Yeshayahu and I read through these verses, I don't think I would make too much of this. I think I would just say, oh, Yeshayahu uses a lot of feminine imagery. Here are some examples. Here's another example. But the fact that the Haftarah opens with this puts my attention on this so much more. And I think this is really where you see kind of, in a sense, the people who've chosen, the rabbis who made the decisions to choose these passages of Haftarah are almost acting as commentary in the very sense that they're blocking off texts where they are. And all of these stories, Avram and Sarah and Hagar and Rachel and Leah and Chana and Penina, in all of these stories, I think something is very clear. The comfort that is offered is for the woman who's experiencing infertility, is yes, the woman has a child, but all of these stories, I think, really illustrate that there's no simple happy ending, which is sobering, and which is not, I think, what we really necessarily want to hear. But the reality is that each of those stories that I mentioned, has a very difficult chapter even after the woman experiencing infertility has a child. So think about the story of Avram and Sarah, how they come to a crossroads where Yishmael is cast out and Yitzchak himself, Akedat Yitzchak, Yitzchak is almost lost to them. Think about the story of Rachel, where she dies in childbirth with Binyamin. So she experiences childbirth, but she dies in childbirth, and Yosef is later sold in slavery. So in a sense, children are lost to her in a way. And Yirmiyahu speaks a lot more about that, of, in the sense, this image of Rachel mevakah al baneha, Rachel crying over her children. Ke'enenu, he uses that imagery to kind of evoke, I think, the sense of Rachel experiencing loss. And think about even Chana and Penina and the book of Shmuel, how Chana has a child, and it's this incredible moment. And she sings this beautiful prayer expressing her thanks to God. And then she does something, which is, I can't even imagine as a parent, which is that she dedicates her child to the temple. So in a sense, she raises the child, to the point where then she gives her child away. In a sense, it's a certain type of sacrifice, honestly. So none of these stories have a really, happy ending. And these stories have complications and tensions. And you're reading about these stories, and it's a moment where you're realizing that the Torah is really purposefully, I think Tanakh in general is purposefully trying to help us realize that a man and two wives is, I think, a bit set up for complications. Be very wary. But also, you really need to have to think about how a family dynamic isn't just solved by the pain of infertility being alleviated. Whatever chaos and whatever dysfunction is present won't be solved just by a child being brought into the marriage. So when you think about this opening metaphor of the Haftarah, once again, I really do kind of see how it's sobering, it's an interesting image. And I kind of was wondering, why was this chosen? Why is this the image to open? And then you take a look at Parshat Ki Teitzeh, and I think here's where we see all of these different pieces coming together. Because Parshat Ki Teitzeh discusses a number of different laws. But one law, which I think is often glossed over because it is very irrelevant to our day and age, it comes right before the story, the laws of the wayward son, the Ben Sora Amora, is the following scenario. Let's say a man has two wives, one loved and one unloved, achat ahuva ve'achat snu'ah. And both the loved and the unloved wives have borne him sons. But the firstborn, the Bechor, is Hayaben HaBechor Lasni'ah, is born to the hated wife. And the Torah then kind of jumps to the future and says, V'haya b'yom hanchilo et banav, et asher yiyelo. And so he's coming to the point in his life where he's sitting down to write his last will and testament. Lo yuchal levaker et ben ha'ahuva al pnei ben hasnua ha'bechor. He cannot favor the son of his beloved wife over the son of the hated wife. As much as he might say, I favor, this is the wife that I favored. I want to declare that son who's going to inherit the double portion. He cannot. Kedabachor ben hasnua yakir latet lo pishnayim. Rather, he has to give a double portion to the ben hasnua, to the son who really is the bechor. So this is referring to the idea of a pishnayim. According to biblical inheritance law, you, in a sense, let's say you have two sons, you divide up the inheritance into three, and you would, in a sense, give the bechor 2/3 of that property, literally a double portion. And the Torah over here is basically saying he cannot do this. It's really interesting, this law, because when I read this law in the context of Chamisha Chumshei Torah, what I'm seeing here is a direct nod to some of the stories in Sefer Bereishit that led to animosity and led to family breakdown. And this law, in a sense, is saying there's a corrective, there's a way of ensuring that despite the animosity and despite the sense that whatever life circumstances led one wife to being loved and one wife to being unloved, you cannot allow that dysfunction to carry on to the next generation. And in a sense, Sefer Bereishit is a cautionary tale of what happens. Think about the story of Rachel and Leah. What happens when Yaakov decides to favor Ben Ha'ahuva, favors Yosef, and how the dysfunction and the tension between the tribes carries over the animosity between Rachel and Leah, which was their own fight, their own vendetta and frustrations with each other, carries over into Yosef's generation. And not just that, think about the story of Shoftim and the story of Shmuel and Sefer Melechim as well, where the tensions between the tribes, in a sense, are carried over. And Sefer Bereishit, in describing the tensions between the Shvatim, are perhaps can be read on the familial small scale. You can be read as a character analysis, but you could also read it as prefiguring this entire generations of tension between the tribes. So this law over here in Sefer Dvarim, I think, are acknowledging that we're trying to correct and trying to prevent a larger dysfunction from occurring. But it's also, I think, acknowledging that sometimes when you read the stories that I mentioned in Sefer Bereishit and the story in Shmuel, all of our focus is on Rachel and on Sarah and on Chana. But sometimes the other wife is also impacted, the Tznuah, right? And you have to have compassion for Leah too. And you have to have compassion for Hagar too. And you have to have compassion for Peninnah too. May not have experienced that direct type of infertility, but there are ways that they experience real suffering. Their stories cannot just be disregarded. And perhaps the directive is aiming, in a sense, to correct that acknowledgement as well. And I think so in framing it this way, it's perhaps a veiled allusion to those previous stories. And I think this connection, do I think that Yeshayahu in these opening words is directly thinking about these laws in Ki Teitseh or directly thinking about Chana and Peninnah or Rachel and Leah? I don't know. Nobody can know that. But in selecting this text to be the Haftarah for Ki Teitseh, it almost becomes a sort of commentary. Sometimes the Parsha and Haftarah, it's very clear when you read the Haftarah that the prophetic narrator had themes and words from the Parsha in mind. Other times, they were written as two separate texts, but as soon as you apply it and take it as a Haftarah, it functions as a commentary. And I think that's what's going on here. And so what I'd like to do now is to go back to the Haftarah and kind of think about how there's one way to read it when you're reading it alone, but there's a bit, perhaps another way to read it when you're reading it with those themes of this law in Parshat Ki Teitzeh and the stories from Bereishit, the stories of infertility and familial dysfunction in mind. So now let's go back to the Haftarah and in a sense, read it with that lens. I think this is really the difference between reading Navi versus reading a Haftarah. Because when you're reading it as a Haftarah, you're reading it framed, right? You're reading a selection, and it's a selection that those who chose the Haftarah chose for you. And you're reading it also with the Parsha in mind, and you're reading it with the time period in mind. So the perspective and the lens is very different. So when we go back now to the Haftarah, to that first opening line, and I noted what I felt was the most obvious reading, which is Israel is this woman who is an Akara, has experienced this infertility, and the prophet is offering comfort that she will have more children. And the more children, I think, are representing a restoration, a return to God, a return to Yerushalayim, right? All the good stuff. And the Shomei Ma, the Bnei Be'ula, this Be'ula, in other words, the espoused woman, the other wife, the other woman, who is that? In the context of reading this as a book of Navi, commentaries address this issue. Ibn Ezra says, it's Bavel. In other words, Israel, you have experienced pain, because God, kind of has a relationship with you, but God also has a relationship with Bavel, right? In other words, God has chosen Bavel to persecute you. And Bavel has lots of quote unquote children. In other words, Bavel has lots of success. Now's your time, Israel. You're going to have more children. You're going to have more success. I'm favoring my relationship with you. Rashi's commentary is quite similar. He identifies, however, the Be'ula, the other wife, as Edom. I think Rashi is trying to show how Yeshayahu is speaking to the Galut he is in now. And according to tradition, there's this sense that after the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, the galut we find ourselves in now, lacking a third Beit HaMikdash, is galut Edom, in a sense, the continuation of Rome, so to speak. And so I think Rashi is functioning very similarly to Ibn Ezra, but essentially it's the same idea. Your enemy was quite successful. You'll be more successful. How are we, the metaphor describes success as having more children. And so it's very similar to Ibn Ezra. But I want to suggest, I think, another explanation that comes to mind when we're reading these passages with Ki Teitzeh in mind. Because the Parsha, the law there that I think is the reason why this specific Haftarah was chosen to accompany Ki Teitzeh is this notion of there's a wrong in the family that we are trying to correct, that we're trying to right. And we've been assuming that Israel is the Ahuva whose children have not been able to be born. And then we have this other possibility that I think emerges, which is when you think about this law in the Parsha of you have one woman who's beloved and one woman who is not beloved, whose children, in a sense, are about to be forsaken, whose children, the father is basically saying, no, I don't want to make you my bechor. And then here comes the law in Sefer Dvarim and says, no, father, you must look to that. To those children as your bechor. You must disregard the feelings you might have about the parent. In other words, you don't love the parent, but the child is still your bechor. There's something remarkable that emerges, which is maybe in the Haftarah, we're meant to read it that Israel is not the woman who is, or the wife who is the beloved wife, but in a sense, Israel is the hated wife of that law in Kitzetze. And we're turning to God and we're basically saying, despite the actions of the parent, can you turn to the child and claim that child as your bechor, maybe once again? The Exodus story kicks off with God saying, "Bnei bechori Yisrael," right? Israel is my firstborn. So in a sense, we're pleading with God, can you please once again accept these children as your bechor? Can you please once again accept us and give us our inheritance? And can you please once again turn to us? And almost in a sense, maybe there's this like alternative ending. And I admit this is speculative, but I think it's tantalizing when you read the law in Ki Tetzeh and then think about the metaphor here. What if the unloved wife could become a beloved wife? What if these stories could have a turnaround? Because now look and let's read the continuation of the Haftarah with some of these ideas in mind. It's not a very long Haftarah. The Haftarah continues, Harchivi makom ahaleich, enlarge the size of your tent. And this was something that we had seen in previous Haftarot, where a woman is told, I'll even go back just to show you exactly what verses I'm talking about in chapter 49, where this is for Parshat Ekev, where also the woman is told, you're going to have to expand. You're going to have to expand your settlement. She says in verse 20, the children you had thought you had lost shall say yet in your hearing, the place is too crowded. Make room for me to settle. So we see this idea being extended here in this week's Haftarah, this idea of the woman being told, you're going to have so many children. You're going to need a bigger house. And this emphasis on which are verses that we say in Lechadodi, Pasuk Dalet, verse 4, Al tiri, don't be afraid, ki lo tevoshi ve'al tikomi. You won't be reproached, you won't be disgraced, you won't be shamed. And I'm thinking Leah, I'm thinking Hagar, I'm thinking of how they experienced a sense of shame and disgrace at, in a sense, their experience of feeling unloved, in a sense of feeling like they were not chosen. And I'm seeing resonance of that here. Look at Pasuk Hey, verse 5. Kibo alayich, your spouse, in other words, your husband, God, Osayich Hashem Tzvakot Shemo, v'goalich Kedosh Yisrael, Elokei Kol Aretz Yikarei, because your husband is basically God. And God is promising to keep you in this everlasting connection. And here is where I see my point, I think, being made most clearly. Ki ki'isha azuva ve'atzuvat ruach, kra'ach Hashem ve'eshet ni'urim, ki tima'es amar elokayich. You were a wife who was forsaken. You were a wife who's cast off. But can you really cast off the wife of your youth? So the Haftarah is acknowledging that you haven't always been, we haven't always had the best relationship as husband and wife. In a sense, reading it through the lens of the law and the parsha, you were snu'ah. But what if there's an alternate ending? And what if there's the possibility of reconciliation, of becoming the ahuva, becoming that beloved wife once again? And this promise in Pasuk Zayin, Rachamim Gdolim Akabtzech, with great mercy, with great love, I can bring you back. And this is where I think we see perhaps an alternate ending or an alternate story being articulated, that Israel as an unloved wife, forsaken, experiencing infertility. You see how these metaphors are shifting what Israel's relationship with God is. Is Israel Rachel? Is Israel Leah? And the Haftarah, in a sense, offering an alternate pathway, an alternate ending to those stories of tension and dysfunction and real pain, of saying, what if there's an ending of the story where not only does the infertile woman, the Akara, have a child, but where the broken relationships from that marriage are restored. Not just that the woman is able to privately say, well, at least I have a child, but where the woman is able to say, and I have a beautiful, loving marriage. So that, in a sense, is the ending that those stories in Bereshit really, really never provide for us. That I think the Haftarah is basically using these themes from these other stories and suggesting. And once again, I admit that this is perhaps a bit speculative. I never would have thought of these ideas had I not seen this Haftarah being chosen as Kitetzeh. And I can't help but wonder if these were the themes and these were the reasons for this connection being made, why this Haftarah was chosen for Kitetzeh. The Haftarah concludes with a clear nod to the covenant that was made with Noach. And I believe these verses also serve, or some of them serve as the Haftarah for Parshat Noach as well. But there's a promise as if to cement the solidity of this covenant. Look at verses 9 and 10, the concluding verses of the Haftarah. Ki me Noach zotli. This is like the waters of Noach. We're going to have a covenant. In other words, this new love, this new reconciliation that we have is as serious as the promise I made to Noach to nevermore bring a flood upon the earth. That's our covenant. And we'll be bound by deep and everlasting love that I'll take as seriously as that covenant that I made with Noach. I think what's going on here is this incredibly strong statement in referring back to Noach, because Noach's covenant, or the brit that Hashem made with Noach, was almost a recreation of the world from scratch, where God promised, I'm never going to again destroy the whole world. And this is almost like the prophet saying, God's never going to break that relationship again. The love that God has promised you will nevermore be broken. So it's incredibly strong language. And once we have that covenant bound by this deep and everlasting love, we have this ability to feel confident that it won't be broken. And this is the antidote to Sefer Dvarim, right? Sefer Dvarim basically suggests a sense of there's a legal document. Each of us has obligations to each other, but there's always the terrifying possibility that one of us won't live up to our end of the bargain and the bond will be broken. And now you have God saying, it's like the flood. I don't care whatever you do. I'm never breaking that bond evermore. So a very serious conclusion that I think really emphasizes how the Haftarah for this Shabbat is really trying to advance the comfort and to ensure that we, the listeners, building up to Rosh Hashanah, really feel this message of comfort. It's fascinating because on Rosh Hashanah, we read the Haftarah of we read Chana's story, Chana and Penina, and we read the story of Hagar and Sarah. We read Akedat Yitzchak. We read these passages as part of the Torah reading. We read Chana's story, and we also read as the Haftarah from Yirmiyahu, Rachel Mevaka Abaneha, the story of Rachel crying over her children. So all of these stories that I think are kind of whispering in the background of this Haftarah, of this imagery of a woman who is unloved becoming loved once again, a woman who is experiencing infertility, who has a child. All of these themes are themes that we read about on Rosh Hashanah. The day that we say we anoint God as our king is the day that we're reading liturgy that emphasizes this bond, this unbreakable bond of a man and a woman in love, and the unbreakable bond of a woman, especially a woman who has never had a child, who finally has a child, and that overwhelming love that woman can have for a child. And in a sense, the overwhelming love that a parent can have for a child, you know, in Akedat Yitzchak as well. So I think that we see this Haftarah beautifully, in a sense. It's functioning not just to speak to Dvarim, but also to provide comfort in the wake of Tisha B'Av, and of course, to lead up to Rosh Hashanah and prepare us for that moment as well. With this, I'll conclude for this week. It's a shorter haftarah, and I'll pause now. I welcome your questions and comments if there are any.
What you said about, first of all, Yasha Koach, what
Thank you
you
so much. I appreciate that.
the, you know, brothers and the discord and the dysfunctional families, that's what makes the Vayechi so touching and so heart-wrenching, because you feel they're back together. I mean, apart from what you're talking about, the mainly, and that Yaakov is going to sort of intertwine them again for the future when they get their brachot. But it's just such a hard parsha to, you know, without crying, you know.
Yeah, for sure. You're saying Parshat Vayechi, where you think
Yes.
everything's all perfect and you know it's not. Those tensions are there.
Right. The attempt of Yaakov is to feel that it is ideal, and that's where the sadness is.
Yes. So I think this notion of what Vayechi kind of almost either teases us with or taunts us with, depending on which way you go, is it's ambiguous. Do the brothers reconcile? Are they a happy family by the end of Sefer Bereishit? And if you drop your email in the comments, I'd be delighted to send you a course. I work at Aleph Beta, and Rabbi Forman, who's the lead scholar there, has a really interesting course on that. I'd be happy to email it to you. Just put your email in the comments and I can send that to you. He really deals with that theme in, I think, a really interesting way of not just do the brothers reconcile, but also why is it so ambiguous if they do reconcile, why does the Torah kind of leave us guessing what exactly happens with them? That's a really interesting point. Yeah. Thank you for that.
I put the video on. I want to show you something. I cannot do
Oh, Chaim, I think you are unintentionally unmuted. Any other comments or questions? All right, everybody.
want to show you something.
Oh, yes, please. Yes. Oh, I didn't
Look,
realize.
can you see it?
I can't. Okay, now I think I see it. Okay, can you describe what you're showing?
What I'm showing?
Yes, I'll pin it
Okay,
so maybe everybody can
it's two
spotlight it.
shofarot.
Yes, I see that.
It's two shofarot, and it's written Kol Barama Nishma, Rachel Mevaka et Baneha. You see
Yes, I see. Yes.
the
Beautiful.
flag, and
Yes.
you have the yellow ribbons.
Oh, beautiful. Did you create that?
Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing. Would you like to take a picture of it and I can email that to the group? Do you have a
Okay, now
scanner?
I don't know how to do it.
Do you have a phone? You can take a picture with your phone and we could block it off and send it out to the group. I think that honestly, if you could make a nice PDF of that, I'm sure we're all looking for Sukkot decorations for this year. I wouldn't mind
Okay,
hanging that one.
we'll do it. I'll send
Thank
you.
you. Yeah. All right.
Say to put
Okay.
the email inside the chat and then
Yes,
you.
just put it in the chat and then I just grab the emails and send out
Okay.
anything. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much. Have a lovely day, everybody. Goodbye.
Dora, thank you.
Much.
Goodbye. Have a great day. Bye-bye.